There is a new bill before Congress called the HAPPY Act. So what does HAPPY stand for?
Humans and pets partnering through the years.
Humans and pets partnering through the years. That was Michigan Republican Thaddeus McCotter, who's the primary sponsor of this bill. NPR's Andrea Seabrook has the story.
The HAPPY Act would allow taxpayers to deduct the money they spend on the care of their pets, up to $3,500 a year. Congressman Thaddeus McCotter introduced the bill. He declined to speak to NPR for this story, saying he is focused on more pressing legislation right now. But he did talk to Doggy TV, a YouTube channel.
Michigan. We're here to talk about a new bill he's introduced, which is very interesting, called the HAPPY Act. Hello, Congressman. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Animal advocate Missy Woodward on the mic there. McCotter explained his motivations for introducing the tax deduction for pets.
Well, we've had reports about people having to turn in pets because of the economic recession. And when you think about the relationship between people and the pets and the humane way that it helps people think, it seemed to me a good idea, and we dropped it in.
Dropped it into the congressional hopper, that is. Now, to be sure, there are thousands of bills introduced every year, and most of them go nowhere. Then again, this bill has a pretty large target constituency, more than half of all Americans own pets, by most estimates. That means there could be a lot of support for this.
Are you kidding? Pets are an option. You know, when you take on a pet, you take on their care.
Not so popular with Beth Selby, up from Georgia to visit Washington. Also strolling the National Mall are Pablo Otera and Tom James from Pennsylvania.
I'm sort of on the fence with this one.
Oh, come on. I spent $4,000 on Petey with his leg.
Petey is Otera's dog.
I fell off my truck, had a surgery, needed therapy, needed a whole bunch of stuff. That's $4,000 I could have deducted out of my taxes. Oh, hell yeah. And food, too.
You can almost see the adding machine in Otera's head. And that's part of the point, Congressman McCotter told Doggy TV, that anything that puts cash back in America's hands during this economic crisis is a good thing. And if it gathers enough support, he says, it could actually go somewhere.
Obviously, healthcare is on the front burner. But when this time comes, if people are letting their members know they like it, would like to see them get behind it, and I think that that would be helpful in this instance.
But until there is a public outcry of support, or perhaps a meow or a woof, it's unclear how doggedly the congressman will pursue the HAPPY Act. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
The big challenge of the healthcare overhaul debate is how to find hundreds of billions of dollars to change the system. One idea is a tax on junk food, in particular soda. Public health advocates say soda is directly linked to obesity, which is partly responsible for skyrocketing healthcare costs. Kelly Weiss of Capital Public Radio ventured out to see if a soda tax could both help improve the nation's health and lower costs.
The Mace Market sits in a suburb of Davis, west of Sacramento. Shiny bags of potato chips, ding-dongs, and candy bars line the shelves. And brightly lit humming refrigerators are packed with bottles of soda. Harold Goldstein is a physician and executive director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. He says this is ground zero.
I am seeing a whole wall of sugar here.
He's heading straight for the soda.
And let me open the refrigerator here and just see what this is. It looks like an obese bottle of Coca-Cola. It is 33.8 fluid ounces. So each of these has, if I do the math,
And the math is 28 teaspoons in that one bottle. Goldstein says it's a problem when someone consumes that much sugar.
So the science is really clear.
He says this science was detailed in an unprecedented survey done by the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. The center interviewed more than 40,000 Californians about their soda drinking habits.
The study that we did with UCLA showed that regardless of income or ethnicity, adults who drink one or more soda a day are 27% more likely to be overweight or obese.
On average, Goldstein says Americans drink 50 gallons of soda a year. So he says we should tax it so the beverage industry pays its fair share for the obesity epidemic. The store clerk, Satnam Chima, is watching our conversation with interest. I ask him what his favorite soda is.
No, I don't drink the soda. I drink the water. I never tried soda.
But he says a lot of his customers have a different opinion, and he doesn't want to see a soda tax.
The more the tax, everything coming more tax, then everyone out of business then.
But the director of Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, Kelly Brownell, says the tax would have a big payoff.
Using tax, much as has happened with tobacco, to try to change consumption patterns in a way that would benefit overall public health and provide a very much needed revenue for programs seems like a home run.
Brownell says a soda tax could generate a lot of money. He and several other public health experts argue this in a New England Journal of Medicine article out this month.
The list of ways you could use revenue from a soda tax is a mile long. But the best use of it would be to make healthy foods more available.
The American Beverage Association says not so fast. Spokesman Kevin Keene says you can't compare tobacco taxes and soda taxes.
You can have a soft drink and be a healthy person. You can't say the same about smoking.
Keene says he doesn't believe taxing soda and other sugar-sweetened beverages like sports and energy drinks and juices will eliminate obesity anyway. Instead, he says, people should take more responsibility for their health. And he adds, a new tax could hurt a lot of people.
We have some economic data that shows there'd be a $22 billion lost in economic output. You know, whether it's jobs, whether it's people buying less product, et cetera. But there's no doubt, and we can see, that it would affect sales.
Still, public health advocates like Kelly Brownell at Yale are banking on a penny-an-ounce federal soda tax. He says it could generate $150 billion in the next 10 years. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are toying with the idea of using a soda tax to help pay for the health care overhaul. But Brownell says at this point, it's still just an idea. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Weiss in Sacramento.
The newspaper columnist Gail Collins says she worked some years ago on a project for the New York Times. It examined the lives of women over the last 1,000 years.
I suddenly realized the vision that the world had of women in the year 1000 and in 1960 was not in its real basis much different, and that I live in that one tiny sliver of time where everything changed, and that just knocked me out.
Now Collins has written a book she titles When Everything Changed. She offers a history of the last 5 decades when millions of women moved into the workplace and demanded equal rights and took a larger role in American life. Collins begins with a story of something women could not easily do in 1960.
In the summer of 1960, a woman named Lois Rabinowitz is in Manhattan. She's a secretary, and she's on her way to the traffic court to pay a ticket for her boss, a parking ticket. And she becomes the central story of the day in the courthouse because she's evicted from the traffic court for attempting to pay a traffic parking ticket while wearing slacks. And the magistrate was outraged. He was just, you're defaming my court. You don't have any respect for the traffic court and its dignity. And she got her husband, Irving, to come. He was a chauffeur, and he paid the ticket. And then the magistrate yelled at him and said, you better clamp down on this young woman before it's too late. And that was very typical at that time. A lot of women that I talked to for the book said that even if it was wintertime, it was just inconceivable that she would run around in pants.
So you tell this story about the way life was in 1960, and then you tell a different story about pants in this decade.
Yeah, and I just sort of stumbled upon this as I was finishing the book. There was a young woman who had applied for a job as a bus driver in New York, and she got the job, but then she was fired because she refused to wear pants. Her religion required that she wear a skirt, and they tried to do culottes, you know, we'll work out this, that. Nothing worked out. And so much of the story that I was trying to write was a story about progress and change. And one person's progress is always another person's loss. You never have a win-win-win-win-win story in this world, I think.
Is part of the conflict or conflicted feelings driven by the fact that women over these five decades that you chronicle here, that women are being, they're not just reaching for new roles, but they're also, in your story, being pressed into new roles by necessity?
Yeah. When I've written about women before, about older periods in American history, and you see how sort of scrunched up women were, what limits there were to their possibilities, there's a tendency to think, well, thank heavens we came along and we were so much smarter and braver and stronger and we took care of everything. But it's so not about that. It's so much about women responding to whatever circumstances they're thrust into. Right now, over the last 50 years, women have taken equal responsibility in many cases for supporting their families. 40% of new births are to single women. Women are 50% of the workforce now, and that's not going to change. You, no matter how many theories you have, how much discussion you have about what women's role should be, that's the way it is. That's what the economy is dictating, and women just step up to the plate and deal with it.
What is thrusting, or what has been thrusting, women into the workplace these last few decades?
It was such an amazing set of perfect storm kinds of things. For one thing, in the 1960s, you had this booming economy, and you didn't really have enough men around to fill all the jobs. So there was this sudden demand that women come back and perform a lot of the white-collar and pink-collar roles that men had done before or that hadn't existed before.
I'm flipping to a Time magazine headline that you found. A good man is hard to find, so they hire women, from 1966.
Yeah, we ran through everybody else, and now we're going for the women. But that's always been true in our history, you know?
Nobody else left. President Johnson here is quoted encouraging companies to hire women, teenagers, the handicapped, and immigrants.
If nobody will come over the border, then we will hire the women. It does sound a little desperate, doesn't it, when you put it that way? But all in our history, it's always been true. Whenever the economy has changed and said, wow, we need a whole lot of people doing office work, suddenly the idea of a woman working before she got married for a while was regarded as a good, wholesome way to prepare yourself for married life somehow. It's always that way. The economy decides something's necessary, and then our thinking kind of fits around it.
I feel like reading this that you do get a sense of women not necessarily grasping an opportunity, but assuming an economic obligation.
Yeah. Well, for some women, it's both. When you open up things like this, for some women, it's breaking open the doors and opening the windows and just say, okay, fly. But for many, many, many women, it's a question of what you need to do to take care of yourself, to take care of your family. Before World War II, we lived very simple lives. We didn't have cars. Most people didn't own homes. Most people didn't have great aspirations. Then the war changed. The post-war economy came in. Everything boomed. And suddenly, on one person's salary, because of the GI Bill and the loans, the home loans, you were able to have a house, to have a car, to have a TV, to expect to send your kids to college. All this stuff became things that people really felt they needed to have. And they got it on one person's salary often in those early years. But then the 70s came and the economy just no longer could support families like this on one person's salary. That was really the point at which people realized that if you wanted to have a middle-class lifestyle, you needed to have two people working. And now I believe women grow up with the same expectations men do for the most part, that it's their job.
When you look at some of the statistics from recent times, particularly when you look at things like college admittance or college graduation and the way that young women now outnumber young men at institution after institution, does that make you feel that the story you try to tell of women's rights changing over the last half century, do you feel like that story's over, it's done?
It's a different story now, for sure. And I find it's so ironic. The very second that you suddenly got girls going through school and doing better than boys on every level, you instantly started getting all these magazine stories about what's wrong with our boys. We've only got two sexes.
Somebody has to be in second
place. Society really can't win on this one. You know, somebody is not going to have the majority of college students. But
so men should be proud to be in the top two, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think men do not need to worry on this front. Once women get out of college, when it comes to moving up career ladders, men still tend to outstrip them. And the one humongous, immense thing that we didn't change, that we didn't figure out how to deal with, is if men and women are both going to work throughout their lives, who's going to take care of the kids?
Mm. And what are the issues that people are still struggling with there?
It's a function of time. There's just we have not restructured the society at all to reflect the fact that most kids don't have a parent who's available to be with them all day long.
Gail Collins is the author of When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. You can find an excerpt from the book and find a review by going to npr.org. We're nowhere near Christmas or Thanksgiving, nor even quite to Halloween, but it's never too early for Christmas songs, especially when they're sung like this.
Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King.
That is indeed Bob Dylan singing Hark, the Herald Angels Sing. It's part of a Christmas album out this week. Christmas in the Heart features all your favorites, performed as only Dylan can.
Dylan is known for an encyclopedic knowledge of American music. In this album, though, he mainly plays the hits.
The album includes O Come All Ye Faithful, The First Noel, and, of course, the song without which no Christmas collection would be complete.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie.
That's from the latest album by Bob Dylan, one of the most influential voices in all of music.
Dylan's voice is a reminder that it's not always obvious what makes a great voice. It's not just the tone, it's the expression, which is one of the things that made Dylan famous.
We've been thinking at NPR News about what makes a great voice, and we'd like your help. In January, we launch 50 Great Voices. It's a series dedicated to discovering and rediscovering singers from around the world.
I don't like crab games with barons and earls. Won't go to Harlem in ermine and pearls.
We want your advice as we choose the 50 voices we'll hear in the series.
Kabhi diwar hilti hai, kabhi dar kaap jata hai.
That's Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, the Pakistani singer who died in 1997.
Find out what we mean by great at our website. And if you think a singer, any singer, dead or alive, meets the criteria, send us the name at npr.org.
Submit up to 5 of your favorites, along with a sentence or two explaining your choices, if you don't mind. The deadline is Friday.
I'm so tired.
And let's turn next to college football, where there's a big game tonight. The undefeated Boise State Broncos take on the Tulsa Golden Hurricanes. The contest gets commentator Frank DeFord thinking of a promising team that we are unlikely to see in big bowl games.
Most football fans want the so-called bowl championship series detonated because by employing only polls and computers to determine its title game opponents, an awful lot of fun is denied us. Hey, we want something like March Madness to determine a genuine national football champion. Besides, it's so unfair. After all, the NCAA sponsors scores of true national championships. Why in Division I football alone should the NCAA be hijacked by six conferences and Notre Dame, which run the BCS in a way that virtually assures that no other college could ever qualify for its title game? But apart from the fact that the BCS robs us of our constitutional right to amusement, it also flies in the face of a fine old American tradition wherein nouveau American colleges have used athletic visibility to hoist themselves up. The classic in this category is Notre Dame itself, which was an unknown little Catholic school in the hinterlands until football gave it a name and the wherewithal to eventually become an outstanding academic institution. This century's Notre Dame in the upward mobility line is Boise State. It's the American dream college category. Make it in football, improve educationally. Sure enough, as Boise wins games, its student applications increase and improve. Boise didn't even open its doors till 1932, and then only as a church junior college. Even now, as Boise has become a national football mainstay, most experts still don't even know how to pronounce its name. It's not Boise, but Boise. And no matter how well the Broncos play, they're discriminated against by the BCS grandees. Last year, Boise finished undefeated and ranked ninth in the country, but three BCS teams ranked lower made the big bowls and the big money. Money, by the way, that can be used for academics as well as athletics. Boise is undefeated this season, too, but even if it wins all its games again, it'll surely be denied the chance that the BCS teams reserve for themselves. What will sink the Broncos is their schedule. Because Boise isn't in one of the six conferences that control the BCS, it can't play many teams that are in the BCS, and that, in a vicious circle sort of way, penalizes it. How about inserting another factor into the computer? In 2006, when Boise played in one of the secondary BCS games, it beat Oklahoma. Now get this. The Oklahoma head coach's salary was greater than the entire Boise football budget. So let's add economic efficiency to the BCS mix. The Boise bang for the buck factor. Or, of course, even better, the NCAA could take back football and give everybody a fair chance to win.
Commentator Frank DeFord takes his fair chance each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne. And healthcare workers in New York State are now closer to not passing on flu to their patients. New rules will require hospital and clinic workers to get vaccinated against the seasonal flu by the end of this month and the swine flu by the end of next month. The idea of making flu shots mandatory is catching on in other states, but many healthcare workers aren't rolling up their sleeves. NPR's Richard Knox has this report.
When it comes to flu shots, New York nurse Gemma Marie Hansen is like most U.S. healthcare workers.
I've never gotten vaccinated against the flu. I was always extremely healthy, never got the flu, and I went through 20-plus flu seasons of taking care of patients without getting it.
I don't need it is the number one reason healthcare workers give for not getting a flu shot. But this year, nurse Hansen will have to get one or wear a mask for the entire flu season. New York is the first and only state to require all workers in hospitals and clinics to get immunized against the flu, both seasonal flu and the new H1N1 virus. Dr. Gus Burkhead is New York's deputy health commissioner. For years, he's led annual campaigns to cajole workers in hospitals and nursing homes to get flu shots. It hasn't worked. New York has never gotten even 40% of its healthcare workers immunized. So this year, they're being forced to get flu shots.
I think it was really sitting around each year reviewing what had happened and all of our efforts and then being disappointed by the end result that we began to come around to this idea that some kind of a requirement was going to be needed.
Mandatory flu vaccination. It's not something that sits well with Gemma Marie Hansen and her friends.
The nurses that I've been speaking to are extremely concerned that they're not being given the information that they need to make an educated decision on whether they should be taking the seasonal flu vaccine as well as the H1N1 vaccine.
We don't really know how many healthcare workers will refuse to get the shot, but some people have very strong feelings about it.
The level of anger that we are hearing is growing, that's all I can tell you. Whether it's correct or not, people are very upset.
That's Joel Shufro of the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health. It's a coalition of 200 union locals. Opponents cite a number of reasons why they're against mandatory flu shots. The vaccine doesn't work very well, they say. It can cause serious side effects. And flu shots can cause the flu. Experts say that's a myth. But Shufro says the objections often come down to this point.
I think that there are a large number of people who believe that this is a matter of principle about what is being injected into their body, and they want control over that.
Dr. Joyce Lammert has heard all the arguments. She's chief of medicine at Seattle's Virginia Mason Medical Center. 4 years ago, her hospital started requiring its staff to get flu shots.
I'm passionate about it. I think it's one of the most important things that we can do for our patients. That's really very easy.
Persuading workers isn't always easy. The Seattle nurses got a judge to rule that mandatory vaccination needs to be part of union negotiations. But in the end, the objections largely faded away.
Since the first year, it's really not been a big issue. The culture's basically changed, and people just assume that it's something that we do in the fall.
Encouraged by the Seattle experience, more hospitals are starting to require flu shots. Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis, Hospital Corporation of America, the nation's largest chain, MedStar Health, a network in the Washington-Baltimore area. Dr. William Thomas is MedStar's chief medical officer.
We're prepared to go through the process of letting people know that they can't work in our hospital.
So you would actually fire somebody?
Yes.
Thomas says hospitals are requiring all kinds of patient safety measures these days, frequent hand washing, preventing medication errors. Requiring flu shots is just part of all that.
Quite honestly, when I talk to people around the country, they all know we should have done this years ago. We didn't have the courage.
The courage to take on opponents. But now, when some doctors have told Thomas they don't want to get a flu shot, he just says, "Let me know the next time you go into the operating room if you don't want to scrub." Richard Knox, NPR News.
You can get tips on preventing flu at npr.org, and while you're there, sign up for our health podcast.